All right, so why are we here? We are here tonight to talk about how to propagate our culture. Why? Because we don't want hackers to end up like the Shakers. Shakers were a religious sect derived from the Quakers and formed in 1747 with a strict ban on reproduction. So it's really no surprise that as of 2009, there are only 3 Shakers left. In fact, when I Googled for Shaker, this was one of only 3 images that came up, and it's a Shaker cemetery. So, how are we going to prevent this? Guns and kung fu? Probably not. As cool as that might have been, keep on taking those Aikido classes. We're going to do it with ideas. Specifically, ideas engineered to replicate themselves across a network of minds. These replicating ideas are known as memes, and they can be far more dangerous than guns. But unlike guns, they still let you carry memes on an airplane. It's about that effective, too. And that gaping security hole is why we're all able to be here together at the Congress, a veritable orgy of infectious ideas. Because if you think about it, the CCC is really like a big 1970s sex party for nerds. You've got Wi-Fi swapping, public key parties, questionable fashion, and when it's all over, some of you are going to go home with a few new viruses. Now, when I showed you that slide, how many of you heard this in your mind? Oh, what? Oh, well. Imagine the song that you probably heard in your mind playing now. There we go, YMCA. Now, when you heard that song, which you didn't actually hear, how many of you pictured these movements? Yes. All right. So, evidently, that meme did not travel to Europe as powerfully as I thought it might have done. So, that is the power of a meme. Maybe it's not that powerful. At least this meme isn't. So, what the fuck is a meme? WTF is a meme. Yes, WTF is a meme. And here's another one. Both WTF and Ceiling Cat began as internet memes, and increasingly, this usage of the word meme is the one that people are most familiar with. Internet memes even have their own conference now. But the term meme existed long before it became associated with lolcats and rickrolls. The word meme was coined by Richard Dawkins in his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene, in which Dawkins advanced a gene-centric view of evolution. Although gene-centric evolution was not a new concept, it was a selfish gene that most successfully and controversially popularized it. The gene-centric view of evolution makes a crucial differentiation between replicators, genes, and their vehicles, organisms. It proposes that we view the gene as the primary competitive unit of natural selection, rather than an individual or a species. Apart from its many clarifying benefits in evolutionary biology, this differentiation more readily allows the application of evolutionary modeling to other mediums in order to better understand how replicators thrive or die out in those mediums. For example, how cultural ideas replicate across the medium of consciousness. Recognizing this potential, Dawkins proposed using the term meme to describe these units of cultural transmission. And although he didn't expand greatly upon the idea, it's only briefly addressed in the last chapter of The Selfish Gene, the idea of memes, the meme, proved too provocative and too virulent to die out. Many people have subsequently expanded and explored the Dawkins humble meme, from English psychologist Susan Blackmore, who in 1999 attempted to assert a science of memetics with her book, The Meme Machine, to philosopher Daniel Dennett, who views memes as ultimate replicators, influencing not just patterns of thought, but biological evolution itself. Consequently, there may remain many different views of how to most appropriately describe memes, a semantic and philosophical morass we would do best not to get into tonight. Instead, I've selected one of the most practical and accessible definitions. A meme is a unit of information in a mind whose existence influences events such that more copies of itself will get created in other minds. A replicator. Here's another definition, this one specifically suited to the existing mental model that many hackers have. Memes are computing instructions for a network. The hardware of this network is people and all of the physical and abstract objects they use to communicate and structure their behaviors. It's from Edward Wilson and J. Wes Unruh in The Art of Memetics. Unlike genes, where we can point to a discrete physical object and say, that's a gene. There, that's a gene. Sorry, wrong gene. Memes are abstractions, concepts in the realm of metacognition, tools for thinking about thinking. This in no way diminishes their utility. Memetics remains a useful model for analyzing how ideas propagate. However, brief caution about metaphors. While metaphorical models such as memetics can be useful tools, producing insights that can in turn be channeled into effective practice, it is important that one never become bound up by those models. A metaphor is merely one possible way of relating to reality. Anytime we impart too much faith in our metaphors, we become less agile. Always remember, the map is not the territory. So choose the metaphors that serve you, where and when they serve you. When conditions change, instantly abandon your model in favor of a more useful one. The enemy's gate is down. Yeah. The title of this talk refers to memes as weapons in a culture war, an assertion that could easily be viewed as mere rhetoric. And while the term war is a particularly loaded one, and here I'm thinking of Ron Gongrip and Frank Rieger's controversial talk at 22C3, entitled, We Lost the War, the fact remains that if memes are constantly in competition with one another, so then are the complex systems formed by many interrelated memes. In other words, culture. Whether we're aware of the process or not, whether we're actively participating in it or not, human minds are, inescapably, vectors of memetic infection. And while some of the memes we spread are compatible with those that they encounter in the minds of others, others decidedly are not. For example, there is no God but Allah, and there is no God. Such incompatibilities were once relatively limited in their ability to come into contact and conflict with one another. But this barrier no longer exists in our technologically hyperconnected world. All cultures are now exposed to the memes of the others, whether those memes are benign or toxic. No one chose this competition, and any more than we chose to participate in evolution. But it is taking place, and the resulting conflict is becoming increasingly violent and increasingly radicalized. It is impossible to step outside of this system of memetic competition, but it is possible to become more articulate about our roles in it. Unlike memes, which are mindless replicators, humans are conscious agents, able to make choices about which memes we propagate and in what fashion. Simply cultivating greater awareness of how our memes affect others is of benefit to all. Of course, I'm proposing that we do more than that. The monolithic cultural and economic systems that have arisen from 10,000 years of human civilization all share a core memetic foundation that is no longer sustainable. Competition, xenophobia, coercion, violence. These memes propagated because they once conferred a strong survival benefit to the minds that carried them. But despite the fact that the initial conditions that gave rise to those memes increasingly no longer apply, their grotesque descendants remain locked in a death struggle, blind and uncaring of the human suffering their conflict is causing. We must resist, actively and immediately. We must become agents of change, using every tool at our disposal to engineer memes that can not only survive in competition with those of the dominant culture, but thrive. Hackers, already adept at identifying and leveraging vulnerabilities in computer systems, are the ideal candidates to identify and exploit the memetic vulnerabilities of cultural systems. Culture war is memetic war, and the revolutionaries of the future must become adept memeticists. Revolutionary memetics is not advertising. Some of you may think, oh, this sounds a lot like advertising. Advertising is by its nature coercive, homogenizing, alienating, and exploitative. It exists to perpetuate the channeling of profit of capital from many to the few. Revolutionary memetics aims to be non-coercive, individuating, actualizing, and altruistic. That is to say, for the benefit of all. Advertising manipulates consumers, imprisoning them in the cycle of desire. Revolutionary memetics aims to activate creators, freeing them to craft their own identities. So, what memes can we propagate to accomplish this? A friend of mine wrote that the economy is like a goldfish. It can seek nourishment, flee danger, but cannot plan or moralize, and has a memory of 3 seconds. Thank you, David Fine. But it's so cute. In its current form, corporate globalization is provably unsustainable. Barring some technological singularity or a magic pony, It totally pees rainbows. It is simply impossible for every person on Earth to enjoy the same standard of living as citizens of the world's wealthiest nations currently do. This obscene disparity, what writer Arundhati Roy calls economic colonialism, has increasingly relegated the world's poorest nations to virtual slave states, laboring in service of the rich, making products that they will never be able to afford themselves. There are several outcomes possible from this. Permanent third world subjugation by the forces of empire, by the capitalist system. Massive ugly revolution, or some form of war. I think we'd like to avoid all three of those. We must supplant this with alternate models before it reaches one of those end games. So we seek collaboration, not competition. We seek sustainability and then collaboration, not competition. The extent to which the internet has facilitated large-scale collaborative endeavors is nothing short of amazing. No less amazing is what these endeavors are revealing about humanity itself. Collaborative projects like Wikipedia and WikiLeaks are both historic and inspiring. Open source software is nothing less than an alternative to economic models predicated upon inequity. And its big brother, open source culture, is rapidly becoming a core value in the developing culture of the internet. In a hyper-connected, interdependent world, collaboration is not only preferable to competition, but viable. Of course, some aspects of hacker culture are obviously competitive, often extremely so. Everyone wants to know who's the smartest in the room, who got pwned, and who did the pwning, whose toaster makes toast, and who wound up with a broken toaster in their sleeping bag. But unlike competition for finite physical or economic resources, reputation-based competition is a non-zero-sum game. One individual's accomplishments do not diminish the amount of accomplishment available to others. Individuating, or actualizing if you're a Marxist. Off-the-rack culture, the dominant culture that has evolved out of the capitalistic system, provides a limited number of cultural identities. The mode of your interaction with the system, the mode in which you are indoctrinated to identify yourself, is through what you consume. The very label consumer identifies you by the action of how you participate in a consumptive system. Your cultural identities are, the cultural identities that are made available to you are only along vectors of that capital exchange. Increasingly, you've seen subculture after subculture reach a point where it becomes marketable back to the next generation. As diverse as these marketed options may become, they don't approach the incredible diversity of individualism that a population contains. We've seen this in the internet, where the internet has facilitated the long tail model of economics, offering many, many products to many discrete individuals. To some extent, when all your choices in a culture are economic choices, and the only cultural identities that are available to you are those that are sanctioned by the market, you lose the ability to fully actualize yourself. You lose the ability to, it's not even conceivable to come up with a cultural identity that's purely your own. The culture that I propose we propagate is one that allows full actualization for everyone, so that you can make cultural choices and pick and build cultural identities for yourselves that exist independent of that economic system. Define yourself by what you create. This is sustainable. Let's see here. What did it? Memetic engineering. So, memes are thought replicators. The goal of memetic engineering is to design potent replicators. The goal of revolutionary memetics is to propagate culture through the use of these potent replicators. So how do we evaluate memetic potency? Susan Blackmore, wrote The Meme Machine, writes that universal replicators possess three key characteristics: high fidelity replication, high levels of fecundity, that is, they make many copies of themselves, and they have longevity. They're durable. As Daniel Dennett says, viruses are genes with attitude. Memes are just ideas with attitude. So if these are the characters of these replicators, how do they transmit themselves? Aaron Lynch, in his book Thought Contagion, describes seven general patterns of memetic transmission. Quality of parenthood, an idea which influences the number of children one has. Children respond particularly receptively to the ideas of their parents, and thus ideas which directly or indirectly encourage a higher birth rate will replicate themselves at a higher rate than those that discourage higher birth rates. So this particular mode of transmission obviously would have had a benefit in early tribal populations, where in a limited resource system, scope system, if you were in competition with your neighbors for the resources of that area, you could propagate more children, you would become more powerful, you'd become more able to claim those resources and grow the most successfully as a culture than if you didn't propagate a lot of children. Two, efficiency of parenthood, an idea which increases the proportion of children who will adopt the ideas of their parents. Really, this is sort of within the family proselytizing. This is one of the most effective methods of transmitting memes. Proselytic, ideas generally passed to others beyond one's own children. Ideas that encourage the proselytism of a meme, as seen in many religious or political movements, can replicate memes horizontally through a given generation, spreading more rapidly than parent-to-child transmissions do. It seems that the efficiency of parenthood, the transfer of memes from parents to children, tends to be more durable than proselytizing, but it's slower. Proselytic movements can spread horizontally through the culture as opposed to over generations like parent-to-child transfer. Four, preservational, ideas which influence those that hold them, continue to hold them for a long time, ideas which encourage longevity in their hosts or leave their host particularly resistant to abandoning or replacing these ideas, enhance the preservability of memes, and afford protection from the competition or proselytism of other memes. A key preservational meme is fundamentalism. Adversative, ideas which influence those which hold them to attack or sabotage competing ideas and or those that hold them. Adversative replication can give an advantage in memetic transmission when the meme itself encourages aggression against other memes. Cognitive, ideas perceived as cogent by most in the population who encounter them. Cognitively transmitted memes depend heavily on a cluster of other ideas and cognitive traits already widely held in the population, and thus usually spread more passively than other forms of meme transmission. Memes spread in cognitive transmission do not count as self-replicating, in Lynch's view. And motivational, ideas that people adopt because they perceive some self-interest in adopting them. Strictly speaking, motivationally transmitted memes do not self-propagate, but this mode of transmission often occurs in association with memes self-replicated in the efficiency parental, proselytic, and preservational modes. Let's talk briefly about a couple of these. Efficiency of parenthood. Freaks must breed. The fastest growing population right now on the planet is the Amish, strangely enough, with an average of 6.5 children per family. How many of you have seen Idiocracy? Yeah, all right. The movie proposes that what's going to happen, or what might happen, is that as highly educated people choose not to breed because of it's such a responsible, it's who we would have to think about that for a while. We'd have to really prepare and get ourselves ready for that decision. And we're not sure if we're economically in the right state to bring our children into this world, whereas the idiots of the world just breed and breed and breed. So they take that general idea out to a ridiculous extreme. That's sort of horrifying. And for any of you who've seen the movie, it's a little bit too close to home for comfort. If the Amish can do it, surely we can do it. Too many people... surely people you see this in subcultures a lot, especially people who, you know, we tend to place a greater value on the individual, and we also don't necessarily consider, you know, there are a lot of political reasons, and maybe we're part of non-traditional households or our families. There are a lot of reasons, a lot of impediments to very esoteric subcultural breeding. We don't particularly, as, you know, speaking broadly about our subculture, we don't typically value child, you know, having this many children as the Amish do. And yet, this is, look at China right now. Not in terms of how many people they're having per family, but in overall population. China is very much in a position to gain great, China and India both are looking to gain great economic significance over the coming century, in part due to population. Proselytization, reach out and welcome others in. Fast doubling, blah, 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 no, okay, I'm sorry. Proselytization, this is an area that we can really, really work on. Eleanor Saita, in her talk this morning about playing with the built city, repeatedly hit on this theme of reaching out to others. If a cultural movement or a subcultural movement only stays within its narrow boundaries, if we wait for others who we deem like us enough or cool enough for us to share our ideas with, if we wait for them to decide to sort of come into our door, our culture is not going to spread. Cultures and systems that value proselytization or evangelizing are going to grow more rapidly than we do. Remember, too, that we're in cultural competition against systems that don't necessarily require some of the precursors that we have. So we're all hyper-connected. We're all, you know, we have smartphones, we have laptops, we have computers. There's a major portion of the world. We're in a minority of the people in the world. We have these abilities to connect to one another via means that aren't even available over the rest of the world yet. Those people are being reached by proselytic means, by evangelism, that targets them through channels that we eschew, that we just don't really consider as necessary anymore, because we can communicate to one another quite effectively through the channels that we have access to. Evangelism. Thank you. Evangelism, or just simply reaching out and connecting to others and inviting others in and sharing your culture and sharing your actions and your beliefs with others. You know, what's the phrase about things we don't talk about at dinner is, you know, politics and religion? Why not? You should. If you have strong beliefs and you feel those beliefs will, if propagated, will be for the benefit of all, share them. Evangelize your beliefs. And do it in a way, and we'll talk about this, do it in a way that welcomes others in, that isn't necessarily confrontational, but rather creates a space for them to try on your ideas. Mimetic immune systems. Well, if you're going to talk to people about their ideas, about your ideas, you're going to have to bypass some of their mimetic immune systems. So let's take a look at some characteristics of mimetic immune systems. Weak mimetic immunity, well, someone's impulsive. I'll go ahead and buy that right now. Axe body spray might just get me laid. Base, sin motives, lust, greed, etc. Not to say that some of these things are wrong, certainly, but if someone is easily motivated by lust, greed, or any of the identified sins, they're going to be very easy to manipulate. Gossip or hearsay. Superstition or magical thinking. But the pony totally pees rainbows. Weakly held beliefs. Guessing. Well, that sounds true. And faith. These are all signs of, you know, someone who doesn't necessarily have a very robust system to defend themselves from new thoughts. Strong mimetic immunity, skepticism, the ability to research or fact check, simply being aware of Snopes, ability to correctly assess the quality of data or its source. In America, there's a significant number of people who actually believe that Fox News Network, that their phrase, fair and balanced, really means that they're fair and balanced. Fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is an incredibly strong mimetic immune system. It's error correction. Fundamentalism in a religious system, for example, says that if you are the best, purest type of believer in this system, if you're following the letter of the law, and if you want to be part of this system, you will follow the letter of the law, that you won't take into account any other options, any other alternate interpretations. You will follow these rules strictly and adhere to them with no question. I recently traveled to a largely Muslim country and had occasion to pray, meet and pray with a Muslim man who explained to me quite enthusiastically about how he prays 5 times a day, which by my reasoning leaves him about 2.5 hours, 3 hours, is the longest amount of time that he has to possibly start to drift and question his beliefs before they're reasserted explicitly in a very codified way with his community. Now, most of us, now, and I'm not criticizing him or his system of belief, but very few of us in our culture, and in a sort of anarchic, individualistic, humanistic culture, a secular culture, do we have that degree of rigor. We don't have that amount of fundamentalism. We tend to be very open to alternate interpretations. So circumventing fundamentalism, circumventing that error correction, error checking in a mimetic system is a real challenge. A tradition, willfulness, strongly held beliefs and witnessing. So we can compare a couple of those, you know, weakly held beliefs, guessing, faith, witnessing, scientific method, you know, adherence to actually proving things through true, as opposed to just, well, sounds about right. All right, so inoculations. Let's see here. Oh, let's see. Before I get to inoculations, let me talk briefly about a couple other barriers. Cynicism is one that was identified by Aaron Lynch. Cynicism is a tough one. In many ways, cynicism is the aversion to the idea of a mass thought. Cynics have the adoption of cynicism as a belief makes them especially hard to move, because not only do they not necessarily believe in the transformative power of ideas, that they're skeptical about anyone who espouses, you know, a new idea or a group idea. So how, you know, think in yourself. We're all cynical in some way or another. Think about things that you've encountered when maybe, I don't know, Burning Man is a common example. In America, especially in the San Francisco Bay Area, Burning Man is a growing popular subculture, and yet many of the people who participate in the event Burning Man go back to their day jobs and their lives as wide-eyed sort of zealots telling everyone about how amazing Burning Man is. And so for people who haven't been to Burning Man and who don't really feel like they're represented by the types of people they've seen go to that event, this talk just seems a bit off-putting. I go to Burning Man. I've been going to Burning Man for 15 years, and it makes me a little bit uncomfortable. That sort of, that just that wild-eyed zeal. Cynicism is hard to move past, and it's something we should we need to be aware of. See, age. Lynch also observes that people are more receptive to new ideas at a younger age, and more willing to act out on those ideas when they encounter them. This is not always true, of course, but as he observes, there's an increased social cost sometimes to acting out on transgressive or esoteric beliefs the older you get. So in general, there's a trend towards conservatism in behavior and a rigidity of belief as most people age. And credentialing, the credentialing system in academia, which is another barrier that largely is now starting to be undermined by collaborative open source culture. But for a long time, you couldn't have an academic opinion, you couldn't have an opinion on certain subjects propagate without having credentials, without having certain letters after your name. So some of the counters to those barriers that I might suggest are valuing enthusiasm or imparting a renewed sense of agency as a counter to cynicism. Valuing lifelong advocacy or radical transparency regarding one's beliefs as a counter to the decreased proselytizing with age. And valuing open source culture and using the tools of algorithmic content moderation like slash.karma and Google PageRank and just the Wikipedia editing system as an alternative to credentialing. These systems are still being designed. Some of you are probably designing them. And obviously they all have some flaws, but it's definitely a more egalitarian approach than simply the very limited credentialing system. Also consider the internet and online social networking as an amplifier for our evangelism, effectively increasing an individual's memetic reach while circumventing at least some of the previous social barriers to proselytization. So, memetic inoculations. Let's look at those. Intentionally introducing a meme, but in a weakened or non-viral form as a defense against future exposure to the real thing. For example, linking the anarchism meme with destruction, immaturity, violence, impracticality. Once an inert form of the meme has been successfully introduced to a mime, future attempts to introduce a different form of that same meme will be much more challenging, as they not only have to circumvent the host's normal memetic immune systems, but the associations introduced by the inoculation. Again, in the US, the idea of anarchism is not, this is what most people think of in our culture when they hear the word anarchism. They do not think of it as a viable system of political thought. They do not think of it as collaboration or consensus. They have been successfully inoculated with this idea, this association of anarchism with youth, immaturity, and destruction. So to propagate any of the values of of the anarchist viewpoint in the West, you have to first circumvent this. And it's a really strong, I mean, for a lot of people, these sort of images are not inspiring. They're quite terrifying. It's a good fun. Who has the marshmallows? Okay, so let's get on to the exploits. All right, so here are some ways that advertisers and other people using these systems have tried to circumvent our memetic immune systems and get their messages through into our brains. Obviously, sex. I'm just going to hit some of the big ones because we've got still a lot to talk about. Here's an ad by... by the body wash Axe. it took a second, didn't it? All right, primal human desire, deriving from a strong genetic motivation, genes being the core replicators of all life, it follows that the sex meme, the concept of sex, sexual attraction, desire, the sexual act itself, would be one of the strongest, most fundamental memes. Since humans began advertising products to one another, countless ideas have been associated either directly or indirectly with sex. Now, one of the problems with pairing your meme, the idea that you want to transmit with a strong primal meme like this, is that the pairing is never going to be that strong. You might be able, through an advertisement like this, to, for a short time in someone's mind, associate a make a connection between sex and Axe body wash. But the next time you ask them, hey, describe what comes in your mind when you think about sex, They're going to describe sex. They're not going to describe Axe body wash, because the sex idea in their mind is so much larger and deeper. That association doesn't work the other direction. It might work just long enough that the next time they're in the store and they pass the aisle with the Axe body wash, they're like, oh, all right, let's try that. I mean, it may not be so conscious as, I'll buy this and I'll have sex, although that's certainly what the advertising, America, some of the recent television ads for Axe have literally been, I wish I had one to show you, literally have just been two people having sex. And at the very end, totally naked, with what you can show on primetime television, and then right at the end, Axe body wash. That's just it, just sex. Nothing more than that. So they've really kind of finally just gone there. But this works well for advertisers. They don't care that that pairing is not durable, because in a few weeks or a month, when you really realize you're just having the same amount of sex you were having before, and that the body wash didn't help, you're vulnerable again to another similar pairing. And they can, it can be for this again, or it can be for another product. So they actually don't, the fact that that's sort of fluid and sloughs off over a short amount of time serves advertising and the capital system really well. Let's see here. Power. The desire for agency in the world, an aspirational meta-meme. The desire for power encompasses the desire for all the tokens and manifestations of power. Money, status, class, and of course, sex. This is the Machiavellian meme. The uneducated man wants to fuck, the educated man seeks to rule the world, knowing that by doing so, he will get to fuck as much as he wants. As Henry Kissinger once said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. A reasonable argument can be made for the Marxists in the audience, that given that Marx asserted that every interaction is an economic interaction, and all economic interactions are power interactions, that basically every mimetic lever, every mimetic motive comes back to being a power motive at some root level. Salvation. The refuge of the helpless, fearful, or failed. If you fail to achieve your desires, sex, power, happiness, in life, we can promise it to you in the afterlife. This proposal is impossible to disprove, making it especially potent. How potent? Enough that some people under the influence of this meme choose to become suicide bombers. Both the ultimate act of self-negation and of negation of others. The exact opposite what revolutionary mimetic seeks, namely the affirmation of self in harmony with the affirmation of others. So this is a very powerful meme, the idea that, you know, if you follow these rules, no matter how failed your life has been, how limited your resources, how great your suffering, there will be an afterlife in which you will be rewarded. So let's see here. Where are we going next? Yes, by and by, by and by. We could all start singing old union songs. And of course, there's this. I have no idea what that's about. I don't know. Could be a coincidence. I don't know. Let's see there. So, where are we going next? Shakti value. Sorry. Thank you. All right. So, no one cares anymore. I mean, shock, again, Eleanor pointed this out in her talk this morning, shock just doesn't really have the same ability to move us, at least in modern Western culture. There are certainly groups of people who would find this really, really offensive. Daniel Dennett you want to come back? There we go. Here, I'll go to this. How's that? Is that better? Oh, wait, how about that? Daniel Dennett calls, he talks about this in saying that we in our culture have developed these mimetic immune systems to things like pornography. Like in a very liberal culture, we don't really think that much as, oh yeah, pornography, no big deal. It's like a mild cold. And it passes over us, or something, you know, some offensive or shocking image. But really, it doesn't move us in the same way. And he points out rather kindly to realize that there are cultures still, the majority of the world who find those images deeply disturbing, deeply frightening, and consider a culture that produces them worthy of elimination. So, of course, this just becomes a joke, really, at this point, playing with images like this and then mashing them up to become something like this. We're so comfortable with what was formerly obscene that we play with it now. So it doesn't really have the strength that it once did. Shock advertising was definitely something that was used. I think looking around at modern media consumers, I think we're fairly able to discriminate. We filter out a lot of these sorts of messages, and I don't think shock gets through in the same way as it once did anymore. All right, so moving on. Branding. The most prevalent mode of increasing memetic visibility in a hyper-connected world is branding. Edward E. Wilson and J. Wes Unruh write, at its heart, branding, or as they refer to it, sigilization, their Discordian memetic magicians, is a technique of encoding memes for network distribution. At its heart, sigilization is a technique of encoding memes for network distribution. Iconification creates a cognitive space for the viewer to identify with an idea. The more iconic a meme is, the more universally infectious it becomes. This universality comes at a cost, however, the loss of specific meaning. Consider a global brand such as Coke, where the product being sold, fizzy sugar water, has become nearly irrelevant to the brand experience being sold. What Zay Frank calls an emotional aftertaste. That's how he refers to brands. When a symbol unmoors itself from what it symbolizes, it loses meaning. It becomes ineffective. That's Arundhati Roy. Thanks to the pervasiveness of modern advertising and a century or two of branding, people are now exposed to a phenomenal number of brands every day, with each brand meaning less and less. This makes branding a relatively weak mechanism of initial memetic transmission. And although brands can still be a strong ongoing identifier, their power is nothing compared to that of direct experience. Build a man a fire and he'll be warm for a night. Set a man on fire and he'll be warm for the rest of his life. All right. Maybe I'm going a bit too far, but revolution is not showing life to people, but making them live. We confer special value to our own experiences. In a place that advertising and many of these other memetic splices can't reach. I suggest that one of the best things that we can do as revolutionaries is try to create the spaces, create context, create experiences where people can experience life for themselves. Don't tell them how to live. Create a space that allows them to try, allows them to have the experience, and then get a sensation, which they will get, that is different from what they get out of mediated mass culture, where they've been given a limited number of options and are participating in a system that is their very complicity in makes them, you know, horribly hypocritical and probably relatively unfulfilled. True revolution must be experiential, not academic or dogmatic. So design memes that create engagement rather than spectacle, resulting in action and not merely observation. So how do we do that? How do we create engagement and not just spectacle and perpetuate the society of the spectacle? How do we get people to have action and not just observe, not just consume? We go to the next slide. No, this is not how. This is certainly one manifestation of that. This is a photograph from Burning Man, and these are people expressing themselves in a way that probably was not, you know, is certainly not available in off-the-rack culture. Whatever this identity is, it's, I don't even know what that is. All right. John Evans, who goes by Resendi online, suggests that Burning Man is a testbed for a post-scarcity future. And I'll get into what that means in a minute. Consensus defines context. So, socially, context is suggested by design, architecture, decoration, sigils, but defined by consensus. For example, consider a church and a nightclub. In a church, people tend to behave with quiet reverence, whereas in a nightclub, people are louder and more animated. They are more likely to dance, become intoxicated, and make sexual advances, all behaviors that they would likely not adopt in a church. And yet both a church and a nightclub are fundamentally merely boxes. There are some architectural differences between them, of course, but these are merely there to suggest the context. That is, to give the people the cues necessary to remind them how to behave in a space. But those cues do not define the context. Rather, shared behavior does. In 2000, I built an art project in the Black Rock Desert at Burning Man, where we created 108 foot tall wooden dominoes, which we intended to leave out for people to stand up. These are each, you know, taller than a person. We intended to leave them out so that people could play with them, make sculptures from them, play games of dominoes, stack them up, knock them over. This gives you some idea of the size. About two-thirds of the way through the event, an 80-mile-an-hour windstorm came and lifted all of our dominoes and took them into a neighboring state. Luckily, we were downwind from the city, so no one was killed by a giant flying domino. In the space that was left, we had about seven dominoes left over, and we turned one on its side, and just in our sort of stunned awe at what had just taken place when the dust had cleared, we started drinking ourselves, and then some people came up and said, "Hey, what is this?" I'm like, "Well, it's a bar. We're drinking. It's a domino bar. What does it look like? We have drinks. It's a bar." "Really? Okay, well, I'll have a beer." And then a few more people came up, and a few more people came up. And by the end of the first night, we had about 30 people drinking at our little domino bar. I went to my car, and I got the only CDs that I brought with me, which are all jazz music, as it happened. And I put on some old Billie Holiday CDs. And all of a sudden, it became a little cozy jazz nightclub. We had no roof. We had no walls. But the next night, people came back and acted like they were regulars. And they showed up in, like, women came back in evening gowns, and guys started to, like, dress a little spiffy and put suit jackets on. And the whole thing suddenly became this amazing interactive collaborative performance between all the people that chose to come to it, with no one ever actually saying, "Okay, here's the plan." And by the third night, even by the second night, you could just step back and look, and what you saw were a bunch of people in a little smoky jazz nightclub. And it existed, and it had this amazing realization that in every way that mattered, that was a jazz nightclub. We didn't have the walls, we didn't have, you know, the furnishings or the lights, and if it had rained, we would have probably all ended up going home. But by crafting consensus between a certain critical mass of participants, for this particular experience, it was about 10 or 12. When it started, like somewhere above there, 15 people, 20 people, all of a sudden it wasn't just you and your friends playing make-believe. It was an actual dynamic social space that could have people leave it and enter it without you doing anything, and it perpetuated the context that had been adopted by the participants without any direction. So how do we do this? How can we take this lesson and bring it out into the world? Context hacking. Eleanor was talking about this. Some of you may be familiar with this. As some types of actions are like flash mobs. Eleanor spoke about one that we did in San Francisco twice this year, once about 8 months ago and once last month at Noisebridge. And it was the Bart Swings project. Whoops. In this project, we went down to the subway system in San Francisco, and we placed a series of these red wooden swings in the BART cars. The BART is our subway system. And this is Audrey, Audrey Penvin, who will be giving a talk on photography tomorrow. This, as Mike Burstein, the creator and organizer of this idea, said, this is easy to do. It's easy to go into a subway system, hang up a train, and have one of your friends sit and swing on it. This is a lot harder. I have no idea who he is. It's just some random commuter, and look how happy he looks. You're like, I want to swing. Yay. I mean, I see a five-year-old boy in his eyes. And so what the way this happened was through that that proselytization, that opening of reaching out to others, not just making this for us, for the cool kids in our little hip thing that we're doing on the BART trains. The way this particular action was structured was that a group of actors, of shills, got on one or two stops earlier, looking relatively normal, and then the rest of us came on, hung up the swings, and left. So the transgressors, the people who were doing the wrong thing, I mean, had we come in and just sat down on those swings and started swinging on themselves, which we could do, there's no real security in the BART system. I mean, there is. If you're black, you'll get shot. It's true. No one would have joined in. They would have immediately had an understanding of what the situation was, a familiar dynamic, and would have been able to use their immune system to kind of wall us off. Like, oh, they're breaking the rules. They're whatever justification they're going to use for shutting you out. They might even report you. They may even get on their cell phone and call security. But by leaving, and leaving it in the hands of all the community of people on that BART train, of which we were not a part, and then having one of those actors go, hey, look, those people left that swing up, and then get on the swing and start to swing on it, and then to enjoy it and find that it's safe and it doesn't break and go, God, this is really fun. You should try it, and point at a stranger. Now, that's, you know, the first person they point at isn't necessarily always going to take them up on that offer, but the second or the third usually does, and very quickly you have that perpetuating cycle where we all get off the train a few stops later, and this goes on for hours. You know, until the security takes the train, the swings off the BART system, you have strangers on their commute home just getting on the swings and swinging. So you have agency to go out and create these experiences in the real world. And I don't know what this is going to do for the people who participate in this. I mean, we don't have any way to really follow up with them. But what we did is we created a space where by shaping that context, shaping that consensus, it was okay to try this. They would have never thought to do this on their own. They probably wouldn't have tried it had we come in and just done it ourselves. But by making it seem like the people that had installed it had left, and that it was just their peers that were sanctioning it, their fellow commuters, well, other people seem to be doing it. I guess it's okay. And it's not coercive. We're not saying, oh, you have to get on it. Come on, man, try it. Everyone's doing it. You just make it an option. You now, by increasing their perception of that shared consensus, you make it something that they feel comfortable doing. You've made a safe space for them. And please, use rope that won't break. You've made a safe space for them to step outside of their normal habits. And some of them are going to, you know, probably most of them are going to remember that. And some of them are going to have a little feeling awakened by that, that's going to make them maybe, you know, if nothing else, a little happier in their life, and maybe that itch of that actualization, that reconnection with simple humanity in the course of, you know, what might otherwise be the grind of your daily commute, might set them off on a path of exploring that feeling and demanding more of it. And that's what we want to propagate. We want to propagate that sense, that desire for increased individuation, that desire for increased humanity and play. So let's see here. Where are we next? Oh, Taz's. All right. So, you know, some of you may have read Hakim Bey, the poet and writer. Okay. So temporary autonomous zones. Burning Man is a good notion of a temporary autonomous zone. It appears for a week and then disappears. We can't take everyone in the world to Burning Man. So we create spazzes, semi-permanent autonomous zones, such as hacker spaces. Thank you. Sarah? Yes. So the growing hackerspace scene all over the world is an example of making these spaces, making these zones that we can perpetuate and we can meet up with one another and have our culture in these physical spaces. Now, physical location is the only way that we propagate our culture. Certainly, we do it over the internet a great deal as well, but this is one of the ways that we can proselytize. Having a physical space and inviting other people into it, and that's the crucial part of this equation, is a way to propagate your culture. Recently, right before we left to come here to Europe, there was a fire at Noisebridge while we were working there. The firemen came in. We were a little bit concerned because it's a hackerspace, and it's, you know, we pay rent. It's a legitimate. It's not a squat, but it's got a lot of strange projects and circuit boards and questionable things, and so I was worried that the firemen might, you know, file some report that would cause us to get evicted or shut down. And instead, they asked, how much are dues here? What is this? Like, first, what is this? And then when it was explained to them what it was, they wanted to know how to become members. That's the value of having a physical space. On the internet, you can create this sort of, you can create intentional consensus or intentional context on the internet as well, of course. Online communities like GenderFork, started by Sarah Dopp in San Francisco, is a community specifically for people who don't feel well represented by the gender binary. And it's a very, very simple framework. And all, I mean, look at the site, beauty and ambiguity. And by defining that context and saying, here is a space where this is normalized, where this is not only accepted, it's celebrated and explored, people come together. Things like this save lives. You know, you no longer have to be that 13-year-old person in bumfuck nowhere questioning your gender identity and deciding you're the only one that has that problem and actually killing yourself because of your, you know, how intense and that your feelings of alienation are. You do a couple searches on Google and you find a site like this, and all of a sudden you realize you're far from alone. So creating spaces where we can draw others in and normalize individual identity without diminishing it, without homogenizing individuals, is one way to propagate our culture. Last couple things. This is a reference to Raymond Kurzweil. This is obviously Moore's Law or Moore's Curve. I was going to briefly talk about, oh, appease rainbows. All right, we're done. appease rainbows. Actually, let me say just one thing. What this was going to be in reference to was immanentizing, the last thought I should leave you with, immanentizing a post-scarcity world by preemptively propagating a post-scarcity culture. Immanentizing, okay, yeah. Here we go. Immanentizing a post-scarcity world by preemptively propagating a post-scarcity culture. What does that mean? Technologist Kevin Kelly recently observed in a lengthy and insightful article on Moore's Curve that while the famous curve may have continued to perpetuate itself due to some remarkable intrinsic quality of the technological world, what Kelly has dubbed the technium, it is perhaps more likely that the curve, Moore's Law or Moore's Curve, the doubling of transistor power and the halving of coughs every 18 months or so, it is perhaps more likely that the curve has endured so long due to people's belief in it, essentially claiming that the curve's predictions held true and continue to hold true year after year because everyone working in the tech industry assumes that it will and consequently acts and invests and invents accordingly. This suggests an incredible potency to widely shared memes, at least in the still uncharted realm of the technium. Could it be, then, that a continued belief in such exponential progress is exactly what is required for that progress to occur? And if so, how far can this method be taken? How much more quickly will the technological singularity, Ray Kurzweil's utopian fantasy, be attained if large communities and corporations proceed as if its arrival is a foregone conclusion? And how much harder will people work to bring about a post-scarcity world if they've already embraced elements and attitudes of post-scarcity culture? So there you have it. And it pees rainbows. Thank you. Do we have any time at all for any Q&A?
Does anyone have questions, maybe? Please come forth to the microphones.
To Yes, it's not really a question, but an announcement, because I know that Simon wouldn't have done it for himself. We already have the Freaks Must Breed t-shirt on Spreadshirt. Just follow just follow Simon Columbus on Twitter, and there he posted the Spreadshirt link for it. That's it.
Hi. Benjamin from Paris. We got some friend of mine from a place in Paris called Oberkampf used to do some kind of what we call urban hacking. I remember that when you show us the swinging in the urban commute. But we got a problem in France is that when you do stuff like that, you often got caught by police or whatsoever. For example, we got a problem when we claim not loudly, I promise, poems in the public park, mm-hmm. and we had about 4 minutes before we got caught and put out of the park. So do you have some quick hint on how we can circumvent or find a way to steal your urban hacking?
Well, I mean, you want, you know, if the culture in is Paris, you said?
Or yeah.
Paris or in France, is that sort of repressive, and if I would imagine you'd want to engage your community and try and get them to, you know, say to the authorities that this is something that they want to, you know, celebrate and allow. You may have to craft your actions to be more subtle or to be more so clearly harmless and so clearly playful and so, like, take into account who the audience is. Take into account who, you know, ignore for a second the police, you know, because they're just agents of the state doing what they're doing, and they're sort of mindless. They're granted power by the action or inaction of the people. So if you want to enjoy greater freedom, you have to get a large number of, you know, the people in your community to support what you're doing. So you can't just go into a place and do an action that without taking into consideration who lives there and how they're going to respond to it, which is another reason why I think that shock, you know, shock and confrontation is so alienating, and it's not going to win you any enemies. And if it has any danger of, you know, to the state will very quickly extinguish it, and you'll have no allies when they come to shut you down. But if you can craft something that the people in that community respond positively to, that they even participate in, you know, families come to Burning Man. And now Burning Man has spawned a network of regional events that carry some of those properties of the Burning Man culture and the Burning Man experience out to other locations in places. I mean, the barriers to entry of going to Burning Man, for those of you who don't know, Burning Man is a festival that takes place in the desert in the middle of Nevada. So it's, you know, it's 6 hours from San Francisco, but we have people coming from all over the world, but you have to go to the middle of a desert and bring everything that you need to survive for 1 week in the desert. That's a lot of, you know, it's a very high barrier to entry. So they're starting to take their culture out into local communities. And the way that they're propagating this culture is very, very thoughtful and very conscious and intentional. Actually, I think this might be a better answer to your question. What they're doing is they're identifying certain components of the larger culture of Burning Man, if one can be said to exist, and spreading those out into the culture in ways that are going to be very well responded to. So, for example, several years ago, the theme of the Burning Man event was the Green Man. It was sustainable energy. And so they worked with solar providers to engineer a solar power grid that powered all the lights for the man itself. So all the neon and other things in the area around the man were powered by a solar array that they built themselves using donated parts and some, anyway. The processes that they used to create that, they then approached a local community in a nearby town in Nevada, a very poor town called Wadsworth, one of the towns that Burning Man attendees drive through to get to the event. And they said, look, we've figured this out. We now know between this supplier who will supply us these things at cost and this government program that will, you know, give you cash for solar panel installs, and our volunteer Burning Man community labor, we can give you a solar panel installation for your high school for nothing. You know, would you like that? And so they went and did it. And they did this test solar power installation that's permanent, that they are keeping, that now powers most of the power for that local high school. And so instead of sort of trying to grow out the culture, the aspects of the culture that are like, hey, we're taking drugs and getting naked and partying in the desert, which isn't going to propagate very well, they take aspects, you know, or you know, the people for whom that respond to that are already going to Burning Man. If you want the people outside of Burning Man who haven't yet experienced the community to value you, you have to propagate something that they're going to see value in. And that they're going to respond positively to. So now, all of a sudden, the citizens of Wadsworth are huge, not uniformly, but a majority of them are really like, oh, Burning Man. They came and gave solar power to our children. So, you know, you may have to choose what your actions are. They don't need necessarily always be, even art, even playful art actions like BART swings may be seen as confrontational. So what are ways that you're, you know, the community that you're a part of, what can you propagate to your community that they're going to value and embrace and then think more highly of you so that when you do something that the police are going to try and shut down, you have community support that says, no, these are part of our community. You can't do that to them. We appreciate what they're doing and how they're contributing. So there's an idea. Oh.
Okay, thank you. We'll try it. Okay. Thank you very much.
Try solar power in France. and then swings. Yes.
I think we're 15 minutes overdue. Yay.
Okay.
Thank you, Aaron. You forgot our shameless plug.
Oh, yes. Thank you. We are actually running on Sylvester, on New Year's Eve. We are running a free street game called Journey to the End of the Year. You should all come to it. It's totally fun. This is an open source psychogeographical game. It's a chase. It's a game of tag played in the city streets. So to play, meet at Alexanderplatz at the steps of the TV tower at 1900 at that 7 o'clock. On the 31st, so that's Thursday. And the website is totheendofthenight.com. That's T-O-T-H-E, and totheendofthenight.com. There are flyers all over the Congress, but you should really consider coming to it if you're interested in any of these sorts of things. It's a fun context hack. If you live in Berlin and are familiar with the city, playing this game is a really wonderful way to experience the city through a different perceptual lens and to shift your own relationship with your landscape. And if you're unfamiliar with Berlin, it's a really great adventure to come to a city that you don't know and then be asked to like navigate a series of checkpoints on a map while not being caught by people trying to chase you down. So it's a lot of fun. It starts, like I said, at 1900 hours, and it's gonna be over by 2230, 2300. There's a big party at the end, but if you have other plans for yourself for Sylvester, it will be over in time for you to go. And Valerie has flyers right there. So if anyone wants a flyer with information about the game, go see Valerie right back there. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.